Hey, if you love Latina to Latina, and I know you do, and you want to support the show, it's as easy as listening on Radio Public, a free, super easy app that works on iPhone and Android. When you listen to Latina on Radio Public, we earn a little bit with every episode you hear. Thanks for listening and for loving the show.
I think of myself as an extremely optimistic person. Like, I don't think you can get up every day and do this work unless you believe deeply that impossible things are completely possible and that you are the person who should try to make them possible.
Jess Morales-Raquetto, a rebel-rousing digital strategist and community organizer, helped Barack Obama get reelected in 2012 and worked on Hillary Clinton's historic 2016 presidential campaign. Now she's the political director at the National Domestic Workers Alliance and co-chair of the Families Belong Together campaign to fight family separation. Whether talking about the 2020 presidential field, the art of keeping activism personal, or dealing with professional heartbreak, Jess holds no punches.
When I asked you how I should describe the work you do, you told me you like to think of yourself as a, quote, political lady about town. I still have no idea what that means.
I really reject being put in a box. I think because I spent the first part of my career doing digital work. And the way that people think about digital work, it's like you write the tweets, you like send the emails. And I always thought of myself as just somebody who like motivated people, asked them to do things that like were for causes they cared about, made an impact. And I just really rejected that label. Now that I've made the transition not into digital work and I sort of just do political things in the world, I like really reject like a title. Also, I have like 5 titles because like why do one thing when you can have like – when you do like 6 things? Okay. So I'm just sort of like a – you know, if there's politics, I'm there.
Okay. I do want to start with the digital organizing, in part because you're the first digital organizer I've ever had on the show. Mm-hmm. What does good digital organizing look like?
I wish more people asked me that question. To me, it is the principles of community organizing. So you know about a lot of community organizers in the world probably. Cesar Chavez, Martin Luther King. Maybe you've gotten some really deep cuts and you've like heard about Saul Alinsky. Perhaps.
I thought that was a twist where you're going to be like, a little guy named Barack Obama.
Sure, him too. Maybe you heard of him. So those people all thought about how do you get ordinary people to be involved in ordinary problems, right? The problems in their communities. And how do you give them the leadership and skills to be able to take the power that they have inside of themselves and fix their pothole or elect a candidate or change legislation, right? Like the way I think about it is like every good thing that we've ever gotten is basically because of community organizing. In the year 2019, that's on the internet.
Right.
Or if you don't do it on the internet, you're doing the real true Lord's work. A lot of those like old school names I just gave you, those are people who are trying to get you to come to a meeting and then trying to get more people to come to a meeting. And then we would go to strike on a picket line. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get millions of people to sign a petition at one time so that we can get 21 Savage released from detention tomorrow. And that to me is like very, very exciting because it's all that like beautiful transformative principles that come from community organizing, but with like a speed and scale and impact that is not possible without the internet. But like all good organizing and all good things probably kind of generally, it lives with relationships. And I think a lot of people think it's like you tweet something or like even you sign a petition or you donate. But actually what I'm trying to do is like motivate people into their purpose and to find other people, whether that's their Twitter friend or their real life friend,
right,
and get them involved as well. And then I think together it's like more fun and also more impactful.
How did you learn how to do this?
I didn't know how to do it, actually. And I was lucky that I had sort of rode the wave of people being like, who knows how to use the internet? Me. And I was like a weird kid and like was really into AOL chat rooms. I made little like online magazines with like my little online friends I'd never met.
I don't know really... that makes you a weird kid so much as it makes you just an old millennial.
Totally. Oh, yeah. Classic old millennial. Yes. 100%. So.
Because I'm like, if that's weird, we were all
weird.
We're
all weird. Yeah, exactly. I had done a lot of stuff on like message boards. I was really into like TV shows that I liked and fandom, and I like got that like, oh, the internet can be a place where you can interact with something so much bigger than you. The best example I have of that is when I was like 19, I became the internet spoiler for my favorite TV show, which was So You Think You Can Dance. True story. And I used to go to the tapings, and I have like a photographic memory almost, and I could remember like everything. And at the end of the tapings, I would get home and I would furiously type out like everything, their outfits, the pairings, the music, like what the judges'
comments
were.
She didn't stick her pot au beurre. She messed it up so bad.
Yes. So like a million people would like look for my spoilers. And that was like my first sort of understanding of like, oh, the world is so much bigger than you realize. And you have the power to communicate with all those people if you want. And then I've always been into politics. I've always been into organizing. Like, I have, like, a weird – if you looked at, like, 8-year-old Jess's reading list, it would be, like, all this, like, civil rights stuff and, like, resistors who stood up against, you know, in the Holocaust, like, proto-feminist, like, books. I mean, like, really, like, my parents were bizarre. I don't even know that they knew what community organizing was. I think they probably just, like, wanted me to learn about people that were different than the people that were in my
right.
community. And so I just was, like, obsessed as a kid with, like, the civil rights movement and also specifically, like, people who helped Jews escape the Holocaust.
How does one even make their way into political organizing, though?
It was hard. I mean, I grew up in, like, a working-class neighborhood.
California?
Yep, Los Angeles. Oh, Norwalk, California, specifically. My dad's one of 10. Basically, all of his siblings were, like, the first ones to go to college. My mom didn't go to college. I don't think any of her siblings went to college. She's one of 7.
And both sides of your family, multi-generation, Mexican-American.
Mm-hmm. My dad's 2nd, my mom's 3rd. And I didn't know anybody in politics. Like, I didn't know anybody in my, like, even if you went out to, like, our friends of friends or, you know, friends of friends of friends, I probably wouldn't have gotten anybody in politics. So I just, from a really young age, is all I wanted to be a part of. Like, I remember watching, like, the presidential debates between Al Gore and George W. Bush and my mom being like, you're not allowed to support Democrats, and me being like, well, you're wrong, at a really young age. Like, I can, like, tell you exactly what Hillary Clinton was wearing and what her, like, hair was like during the Beijing, like, China speech. And I was, like, a very small child when she gave that speech. Like,
well,
yeah, I just – it calls to me so deeply. So I always, always wanted to be a part of it. I thought the stuff I was doing in college would really, like, help me get a job right away. Not so much. not so much. And I spent a year and a half, like, applying to any job I could think of, like, doing informational interviews. And it turns out that, like, you really have to know people.
Mm-hmm.
And you usually have to have done some internships. We were not like that. I went home and worked during the summers, and that was the money that I could live on
right.
during the year. So free internships, like, somewhere else. We couldn't afford it.
Right.
So for me, I ended up going to the training program of this group called the New Organizing Institute, which is now sadly defunct, but at the time was a really important training institute that got a lot of people, kind of got their start. They had this signature training called Boot Camp, and Boot Camp was like a feeder for a bunch of organizations and campaigns to then hire kind of their entry-level staff. So it took me a long time, but once I went to that training and did pretty well at that training, it kind of took a few more months, but then I eventually got my very first job, which is actually being the training associate for that next year boot camp class.
Hmm.
And then I met one of the trainers there. She was really impressed with me, and she ended up finally, like, hiring me, and sort of the rest kind of happened from there.
During the Clinton campaign, supporters would get text messages saying, "Hi, it's Jess,"
mm-hmm.
and those text messages were from you.
Mm-hmm.
Did people respond?
Oh, my gosh. Like, actually, I say that it's, like, the most intimate form of messaging, because what we would get back was, like, people who accidentally message us when they were saying stuff like, "I'll be home late, my flight's delayed." One of my favorite things is that people would find me and be like, you text me like more than my boyfriend does. Like, you text me literally more than anyone in my life. I'd be like, well, it's really important.
Yeah. It's real important. Election night 2016. You dedicated more than a year of your life to helping Hillary Clinton become president. What do you remember about that day?
The day was amazing. I walk into headquarters and see like a friend who had done a little bit of work with the campaign. And he's like, oh, I'm so glad I get to start my day with you. Like, we're going to make history. And I'm totally going to cry shit. My husband had written me a note. He like wrote me a series of notes for the last 30 days of the campaign. And he wrote me a note that said, today, some of history will have your handwriting on it. And I thought about that all day long. And I mean, I still think that's, he wasn't wrong, even in the terrible outcome. But like one thing that I think people think is that like we just walked around being like, we're going to win all the time. Like you don't do that on a campaign. It just doesn't work like that. We knew that polls were a lot tighter than people thought. And like this was one of those moments where it was like, okay, I am a person who has the power to like move people today. I'm a person who has the power to like tell millions of people to stay in line when there's long lines at the polls. And then results start coming in. They're not going quite the way that we thought. And it's getting later and later, and it's looking scarier and scarier. And
did you know in your gut?
Yeah. So I always tell people two things. So one is that we still have never elected the first female president of the United States. And it doesn't matter who it was always going to be hard. But the second thing is that we've also never elected a Democratic president after a two-term Democratic incumbency. So that was also going to be difficult, even if she wasn't the first female president. So I was never a person who, like, thought that it was in the bag. Like, if it was in the bag, it would have been easier the whole time.
But at what point in the night did you know definitively this is done?
When the Florida polls closed and they started counting Florida, that's when it started to look pretty scary. But I think that a lot of people almost didn't believe that that was possible. Mm-hmm. That she could lose. And so I went to bed that night at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I thought that they sent me home because they were like, you might have to do provisional ballots. You might need to lead provisional ballot chase in the morning. So go to bed because like we need somebody.
That night things felt undone.
On our side, I think that there was a little bit of like, how did this happen? Did it actually happen? Voter suppression is real. We knew that that was a problem. And I do think a little bit of disbelief. Yeah. I think, like, there's no way this could happen, right?
Isn't that one of the stages of grief?
I think so. And it did feel, I think people forget this too, it felt so ominous that next day. Like, it just felt like, for me, it just felt like there was, like, a curtain over everything. And, like, I didn't know what to do. Like, what do we do next?
Was there any part of you that thought, I'm done with politics?
No. I did feel like I need to take a break and get my shit together. I had 80 staff members that needed to get jobs. I needed a job. So it was just like, okay, you need to get in a good enough shape that you can do what you're here to do. And that is like, change the world. And now it's just going to be a lot harder than you thought.
If you are as busy as I am, then I have a life hack for you. I've recently been enjoying Green Chef. It's a USDA certified organic company, and they have a diverse array of meal plans with plenty of options to choose from each week. You can choose paleo, vegan, vegetarian, pescatarian, Mediterranean, heart smart, lean and clean, keto, gluten-free, and omnivore. For $50 off your first box of Green Chef, go to greenchef.us/latina. Their recipes are quick and easy with step-by-step instructions, chef's tips, and photos to guide you along. This week, I made my husband and kiddo salmon and piccata sauce. It tasted fresh and delicious, and my daughter might have even eaten the sauce with a spoon. Best of all, everything is hand-picked and delivered right to your door, so no more decision fatigue. Let Green Chef do the meal planning, grocery shopping, and most of the prep for you. For $50 off your first box of Green Chef, go to greenchef.us/latina.
If you have a little one in your life, I'm guessing you have a Paw Patrol fan on your hands. So get excited. There's a brand new episode Monday, March 4th on Nickelodeon, featuring Tracker, the jungle pup, who, wait for it, speaks Spanish.
Un momento. I hear a banana being peeled and the ting-ting of something metal banging against a tree trunk.
I like watching Paw Patrol with my daughter because each episode has great lessons about bravery, but things never get too scary. You and your little Paw Patrol fan won't want to miss Tracker, the Spanish-speaking pup. Catch a brand new episode on March 4th on Nickelodeon at 12, 11 Central.
Muchas gracias!
You're now the co-chair of Families Belong Together, which is a campaign to fight family separation. How is that work similar and different in nature from an electoral campaign?
Yeah, you ask really good questions. I mean, it's in some ways it's the same because you have a goal and you're trying to like move everyone towards that goal. And in the case of both of them, there's like a real urgency. And it like
and
there's
you're
an expiration date.
Towards a deadline.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In some ways, family separation was like that. That sort of moment this summer at the border was like that because this policy got put into effect, and then immediately thousands of families were separated, and we wanted to end that practice as soon as possible.
Right. The challenge with family separation is getting the policy to end was not the end point.
Nope. It wasn't. People who work on immigration are not always expecting to, like, win, right? Probably because it's so complicated, there isn't always, like, a clear win. In our case, we had one clear win very early on, which is that we were trying to get them to end the zero tolerance policy. And that was very helpful in clarifying. And then there's also like the 100% understanding that you can't trust the Trump administration on immigration policy and that ending the zero tolerance policy did not mean that families wouldn't be separated or that all these families be reunited. It is a challenge to engage in deeply emotional work and know that the people that you're engaging in that right. work with and for, actually it's way more emotional right. and difficult for them, right? right? And also to try to galvanize as many people as possible for something that could go for a very long time.
Well, especially because this in particular, I mean, you have the politics of it happening,
mm-hmm.
which are, you know, what Republicans and Democrats are fighting about, which is like up here. And you have the policy piece of it, which is the both the policy of separating parents and their children and the policy for how you're going to handle that fallout.
Yep.
You have a humanitarian crisis where you have mothers searching for their children and children searching for their mothers. And also just direct services
yep.
at the border that are trying to get people in clothing and get them fed. And
diapers, shoes.
I mean, where do you even start?
Yeah. I mean, there was just like a cadre of like amazing women of color and we all just like buckled down. It was like, all right, you're taking legal and you're taking media and you're taking Ledge. And, you're, you know, I think that was also partly what made it work is that everybody was really clear about where we were kind of running towards.
I knew that we'd hit a tipping point when my apolitical friends were sending BCC emails, either asking for goods to be sent to shelters or and every email started with, you know, I'm not a political person, but I am a mom.
Yeah.
And that's when I was like, this is
Whoa.
Different.
Yeah. There was a moment. So right before on June 30th, we had 799 rallies all around the country, something like that, over 700, which is one of the largest pro-immigrant protests in the history of American country, of this country.
I think part of the reason there was such a visceral response was because we saw such incredible images.
Yeah.
I don't know that I can talk about this without crying, but all of those videos of kids being reunited with their parents and rejecting their parents,
yeah.
not recognizing their parents. For you, who's I have to imagine has spent some time on the ground, is there one image or one experience that sticks with you?
Yeah, on Father's Day, we did a vigil outside of kind of one of the main detention centers where they were holding most of the children. And it was for a father who had killed himself in detention because of being separated from his family. And as we're doing the vigil, the detention center is in front of us, and a bus comes out of the detention center. The bus is a caged bus. It's just full of cages, and there are children inside the cages. And they put their hands We started, you know, we were just like losing our minds and we're saying, no, están solo, you're not alone. And they put their hands on the windows of the bus and they drove away.
And I was like already like very committed to that work. And in that moment, I think like I became like, it was like tattooed on me in some way. Like there's just no, I like challenge literally any person to experience that and feel like this is humane or just, or like you can look away. Like you just can't look away. It's, I'll never forget that. They were little, they were really small hands.
So there's clearly an emotional toll to doing this work. What else does this demand of you?
Okay, so I think of myself as an extremely optimistic person. Like, I don't think you can get up every day and do this work unless you believe deeply that impossible things are completely possible and that you are the person who should try to make them possible. And I think it is actually very difficult to maintain optimism in this current moment doing this work, because this is work that demands your full heart. If you're not bringing that to it, like, listen, there are way better hours, way better pay, way better conditions than basically any other industry.
Okay, but what I don't understand, this is one of your jobs. So you're also political director yep. for the National Domestic Workers Alliance. Yep. What is that work? And when are you doing it?
Implicit in that, like, sort of question is always, like, how do you, like, balance? And the answer is, like, I don't balance. I work, like, all the time. Most of the time, I don't take weekends off. I spend at least 2 to 3 days a week on the road. It turns out when you work, like, 150 hours a week, you can get a lot done. And I don't know. Like, I think you're supposed to sort of be like, oh, I'm so efficient. It's just, like, really good time management. Like, and frequent flyer miles. Like, no, it's not. I work all the time.
Also, is, like, your house messy?
I, like, Marie Kondo'd a couple years ago because I read the book instead of watching a TV show. And, like, that helped me out a lot. But, like, yeah, occasionally I'll come home and be like, oh, it's been 3 weeks since, like, any broom has touched the surfaces of these floors.
And so tell me about the work with National Domestic Workers.
Yeah. So my job as political director is to build out our kind of electoral and legislative arms. So we did the very first kind of big project of that last year in Georgia to elect Stacey Abrams governor. Came up a little bit short. Also an emotional election night and an emotional 2 weeks afterwards. But we had the largest, one of the largest programs on the ground to elect Stacey.
Because when we talk about a domestic worker, mm-hmm. who are we talking about?
Nannies, house cleaners, and elder care workers that work in your homes.
And so majority women of color.
Yeah, like 99%, both of those things. Lots of immigrants as well. Less than most people think, but like a very heavy immigrant population. So what we did was, Georgia is where we have a big base, and Stacey's candidacy was a historic candidacy. It was kind of the perfect mix of two things. So we built a huge on-the-ground operation, hundreds of canvassers. We had over 500,000, we talked to 500,000 voters about why they should vote for Stacey and also candidates down ballot. We also employed our workers as canvassers, which most people do not do. And it was kind of amazing. Like, I don't think anybody had ever, I don't think if you're looking around, like, who are big political forces in America, you're thinking about the domestic workers. But, like, that's kind of my mandate is, like, how do we make people understand that the future of politics should be low-wage women, it should be immigrant women, it should be women of color, especially black women. That's what we're trying to do. And in Georgia, I think we had a really, really good kind of proof of concept of, like, yes, it's totally possible.
Here is a line I have ripped from your LinkedIn bio. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for someone to tell you what you want to hear, you've come to the wrong place. And I feel like I'm about to get that treatment on my next set of questions. Typically, political wisdom says that Latinos favor Democrats and voting history backs that up. But is the narrative actually more complicated?
Definitely, especially among Latino men. I mean, like, they're much more conservative than we realize. They were one of the most vulnerable groups to being persuaded by the Trump message in 16. And I am extremely worried about what happens in 20.
Do you think that's because they become acculturated? Do you think that is the economic aspiration? I mean, what do you think drives that?
I definitely think it's economic aspiration. I think there is, like, some of the dregs of machismo that they're responding to in Trump in particular. I think they really like that Trump is a businessman. Really, really like that. So my hope is that the terrible immigration policy will have changed that. But I think people think, Latino, you're not voting for Donald Trump. And that's just not true.
Wait. Jess, thank you so much.
Thank you. This is the win.
Thanks for joining us today. Latina to Latina was originally co-created with Bustle. Now the podcast is owned and executive produced by Juleka Lantigua Williams and me. Maria Muriel was the sound designer on this episode. We want to hear from you. Tell us who you want to hear from and how you're making the show a part of your life. Email us at hola@latinatolatina.com. Remember to subscribe or follow us on Radio Public, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening.